couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Death on the Nile, Marry Me, Blacklight, I Want You Back, and Minamata. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Paranoiac and Gintama, the very final. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Jackass Forever did best in the weekend last week, but it was still the lowest performing Jackass movie. Not a big surprise considering the way things are going and the very soon availability that this thing's going to have on streaming. But let's talk about something that has nothing to do with the Jackass movie, and that is the Oscar nominations. At this point, we're getting to the stage where the Oscar nominations are so non-surprising that we have so many awards, either award shows, but also regional awards. Every critic organization has its own awards. I vote in several of them. So by the time the Oscars roll around, people are like going, are we still talking about some of these movies? The thing that really jumped out at me was how very few surprises there were. And we had that in the last couple of years. And I don't get into the snubs. I know there's a lot of people who are like, well, the snubs of this category, for example, the interesting point of Denis Villeneuve not getting a directing nomination for Dune, which a lot of people say will torpedo the chances of Dune winning Best Picture. Unlike some previous years, all the films that got a directing nomination also got a Best Picture nomination, which tends to lean more for those five films to be favored over the other five films that didn't get a director nomination. But the thing that's worth noting is Troy Kotsur for Coda. He is a deaf actor, and he's the first deaf actor to be nominated for Best Supporting Actor. Now, of course, Marley Matlin, who's also in this movie, she had won an Oscar for Children of Lesser God way back in the 80s. But, you know, this is a big deal for people with disabilities, especially people in the deaf community. This is something to herald and be excited about. The other thing that I thought was kind of a surprise, or at least something notable, is Drive My Car, which is a Japanese movie, got nominated for a whole bunch of awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. And that kind of builds up its chances. Now, we've had this happen before. The last time this happened very prominently was when Parasite won, and it ended up winning Best Picture. So that is a possibility, although the Academy doesn't like to repeat itself in sort of its surprise bumps or anything like that. So I don't know whether Drive My Car is going to actually get the traction that, say, Parasite did. But the other thing to notice is the presence of streaming titles on here. Now, of course, we were neck deep in a pandemic, and there was still a hybrid model going around in terms of theatrical releasing. But everything that's on the list that came out from Warner Brothers, including Dune and King Richard, were available on streaming on the day and date. There were movies that were on Prime Video that did get a theatrical release, but were mostly seen on Prime Video, like Being the Ricardos. I just mentioned Coda. That and The Tragedy of Macbeth were both Apple TV productions. And then Netflix has a great year with Don't Look Up and The Lost Daughter, Tick, Tick, Boom, and The Power of the Dog, all getting a lot of note here. And with The Power of the Dog, that thing actually has a real chance to win Best Picture. If you look at some of the other critic organizations and other award ceremonies, Power of the Dog has done quite well. And with the number of nominations Power of the Dog got, it's topping the list as well. So Netflix may be able to pull off a Best Picture win, which they weren't able to do with movies like Roma or The Irishman a couple years ago. The other piece of news I wanted to talk isn't really news, but it's sort of a wrap-up of something. I want to talk about The Book of Boba Fett. They had the finale this week. And one of the things I've been noticing is the sort of manic, depressant reaction that some fans have been having about the Boba Fett series. Now, first of all, there's some people who treated this like it should have been The Mandalorian Season 3. And it's not. It's about Boba Fett. And it's about Boba Fett being trapped on Tatooine and then trying to rebuild Jabba the Hutt's criminal empire on Tatooine, because he was in the freaking Sarlacc pit at the end of Return of the Jedi. So this was him healing and getting out, and he didn't exactly have his ship anymore. So there were some people who weren't happy with it. Now, I personally loved the Boba Fett series. I thought that was a lot of fun. It had some cool things. It had a lot of throwbacks. But there's a lot of things that some people didn't like. One of the things is people are complaining, well, we have too much stuff going on Tatooine. Can we just get off Tatooine for once? And, oh, well, you know, Boba Fett talked too much. And, oh, he didn't wear his helmet enough. Look. Here's the thing that I found so interesting was how polarizing this was. And when you looked at the reaction when I finally did the finale, which I'm not going to spoil anything if you haven't had a chance to watch it on Disney Plus, but it really polarized. I mean, there were people who hated it. There were people who said this is the worst thing I've ever seen from Star Wars. And then there were some people who loved it. I personally loved it. I thought it had a lot of fun and throwbacks. And you got to remember, this is a spinoff series of a spinoff series. I mean, The Mandalorian was a spinoff. Then they spun off Boba Fett with that one. I loved what they did with the Book of Boba Fett. But it's interesting. You got to remember, this is episodic stuff. These are like old TV shows or comic books. I'm sort of digging through my old comic book collection. I recently moved and I dug up a lot of my old comic books, and I'm going through a whole bunch of them, just everything from Marvel to DC to from The Thing to Hawk and Dove. I'm reading a bunch of different comic books. But you got to realize, not every issue, not every episode on TV is going to be something that everybody loves. With Star Wars, they're not used to Star Wars being episodic, even though it is. It's in episodes. But they're used to having a movie, and then several years later, or many years later, another movie coming out. I mean, they look at it saying there's only 9 movies, if you don't count Rogue One and the Solo movie. But the TV series, there's 7 episodes of Boba Fett. There's like 2 seasons of The Mandalorian. You've got Obi-Wan Kenobi coming up in May. Each episode is not there to redefine an entire series or universe. It's not meant to change things. It's not meant to be iconoclastic like that insufferable The Last Jedi movie. It's Pulp Fiction, for crying out loud. And if it wasn't grand enough and big enough and deep enough and contemplative enough and, oh, it's just kid stuff, that's what Star Wars was from the beginning. So get over yourself and just enjoy it. I was entertained for a half hour to an hour every week for the duration of this run with this series. So I enjoyed it. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is the film Men, which is coming to theaters on May 20th.
What are you doing here? Why are you doing this?
This is directed by Alex Gardner. He's best known for doing Ex Machina, and then he did Annihilation. And I know there's a lot of people who love Annihilation. I thought Annihilation was not a good science fiction movie. It was problematic at best. I did like Ex Machina quite a bit. But Men looks interesting. We don't get much about it. It seems to be this woman tortured by either a spirit or a past or guilt or something. It looks very mysterious, but I'm looking to check it out. The next one I want to talk about really quickly is Firestarter, which comes to theater and on Peacock. We're still doing the hybrid releases in May on the 13th.
It happened again.
What happened?
The bad thing.
If you ever start to lose control, what do you do?
It didn't work.
She's not a robot, Annie. She's a little girl. With little girl emotions, which are wildly unpredictable.
Charlie?
She just has to shove it down and keep it hidden.
Our responsibility is getting her ready.
Our responsibility is to protect her.
Charlie?
If they catch her, they're going to put her in a cage. They're going to run tests on her for the rest of her life.
Personally, I loved the original Firestarter. I know Stephen King hated it, and I know it has some really goofy things in it, but I really liked the original 80s version of the Firestarter story with Drew Barrymore, and you had George C. Scott in there, and you had Martin Sheen playing a different character than he did in The Dead Zone. I liked that original movie. I recently went back and watched it, and I still enjoy it for what it is. I'm curious to see this. I actually am most interested in seeing Zac Efron taking a less sexpot-looking character. He's just going to be playing a dad in this. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Marry Me and I Want You Back.
Hey
to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the new movies. And since it's Valentine's Day weekend, and Valentine's Day isn't actually until Monday, but everybody's celebrating Valentine's Day as we lead up to it, like, you know, Friday, Saturday night, and maybe people are going to go out on the 14th, which is Monday, but nobody wants to celebrate Valentine's Day next week. So we're going to be celebrating it this week with a couple movies that are meant for romance and meant for dates. And the first one is Marry Me. Jennifer Lopez stars as a pop diva who plans to marry her boyfriend at a concert, but right before she takes the stage, she learns he has cheated on her, so she marries a random dude in the audience.
They say if you want something different, you have to do something different. Yes, I'll marry you. You.
Do you, some guy, take Kat to be your lawfully wedded wife?
Okay.
That was crazy.
Kat Valdez left the guy from the concert, then also married her Uber driver.
It's an insane situation. I say we offer $5,000 and let it all blow over.
Or I could stay married to him.
I gave my opinion of this to somebody this week, and they said, oh, well, it's just a silly rom-com. And I'm like, yeah, I'm usually a sucker for that kind of stuff. I genuinely like romantic comedies. I like the formulaic, cheesy romantic comedy. Not a big fan of Jennifer Lopez, but it's not even her. I mean, I guess it is partly her that's the core of the problem with this movie. It's because they're making the character her, but it's like this was written 15 or 20 years ago for her, and they finally just got around to doing it. And then on top of it, it's like they filmed the entire movie with Jennifer Lopez and then cast Owen Wilson as the guy later and just like blue screened him in and did a couple reshoots, because it feels like the characters are completely separated. And you can do a good romantic comedy with the two characters being completely separated. I think that they effectively do that in Sleepless in Seattle. I mean, they don't even meet till the very end of Sleepless in Seattle. That's not my favorite Nora Ephron movie, but I think she was very good at putting together that sort of snappy 80s and 90s romantic comedy, and I think that does work. But in this one, it's like they're two different characters, and there's no depth at all to Owen Wilson's character, because he plays the guy she ends up marrying because he's got a daughter, and he takes a daughter to the concert. But it also feels like they were wanting this to be Jennifer Lopez when she was much younger. And look, don't get me wrong. Jennifer Lopez looks fantastic. She looks great. But she's like 52. And there's a line in the movie where somebody says to her, going, well, she's north of 35. And I laughed out loud. And I'm like, north of 35? She's north of 45. She's north of 50. I mean, she looks great. She does look fantastic. She looks fantastic for 35, but she looks fantastic, certainly fantastic for 52. But let's not forget the fact that she is 52. At least Owen Wilson's a comparable age. He's like 52 or 53. So at least they're the same age. But they're like playing them as if they're younger people in this. I mean, you feel like this is written for people in their 30s, not people in their 50s. The other thing that happens is you know, we've seen these movies before. You know, the people getting married, then falling in love. We saw that with What Happens in Vegas. Remember that movie? I think it was Ashton Kutcher and Cameron Diaz, which is about 14, 15 years ago, where they met in Las Vegas and they partied, got married, and they came home and they were sentenced to be married by a judge. So we've seen these movies before where they have to learn to like each other. But the problem with this one is the story. It's like there's two different stories and they don't get out of each other's way. Jennifer Lopez's story is, I just want to let my life slow down. But they still make her absolutely brilliant. She's a great singer. She can connect with people. In reality, you'd have some flaws with her character, but they don't have any flaws in her character. So she just sits there and is, I'm an awesome diva. And then you have Owen Wilson, he's not plugged into social media, and he's a teacher. For some reason, he's a teacher in New York City who can afford this gorgeous loft apartment and he's a single dad. I don't know how any of this works out on a financial level for him. But he like doesn't engage in social media, and she's teaching him TikTok, and they're doing that. But there's no like payoff to that. I mean, there's, you know, like in a normal movie would be written where Jennifer Lopez's character is obsessed with the social media and then it would just turn out to be like, look, you just live your life and have a good time and don't try and make your life more than you're not performing for these people 24 hours a day. But that message just, it just evaporates and never actually, you know, has a through line to kind of deliver any message. It's just like this happens and he doesn't have social media, and then she shows him a social media, but he doesn't really get one. And Then, like, he's got this daughter, and you expect her to have this great relationship and connect with it. They don't even meet the daughter for, like, I mean, I swear to God, the movie's like 2 hours long. And, oh, it's just excruciating. It's just so boring. It's a gorgeous-looking movie, and I give it credit. I mean, it tries. It really, really tries, but just nothing connects in this movie. You know, it feels like an AI wrote the story and filmed it, but didn't actually understand how characters and interaction and human emotion works. I did not like this movie. And Owen Wilson looked about as excited being in this movie as I was watching this film. So this thing's awful. This thing totally sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about another romantic comedy, and that is I Want You Back. Jenny Slate and Charlie Day star as two friends who are dumped, then they hatch a plan together to break up each other's subsequent relationships.
Just got dumped.
Oh, me too.
Oh my God.
He was the love of my life.
And is the love of mine.
But I'm not so sure that they're gonna realize it, not with these shiny new people around.
So what are we supposed to do?
We have to break them up.
I will seduce Anne's boyfriend. You will friendship seduce Noah.
Look at you. Good work.
Yeah, man. I'm a psycho.
This is another one where the characters are weirdly older than they should be. Yeah, Jenny Slate is maybe a little more appropriate to her age because she's, what, around 30? But Charlie Day's, you know, he's like, he's got to be, if he's not 40, he's really pushing 40. And it just seems like he's a little bit too old to be doing it. Plus, he's dating Gina Rodriguez, and you're like, well, a little old for her, aren't you? But this is on Prime Video, so you can catch it at home for free if you've got the Prime Video service. There's a bit of an obstacle with the premise because you got to show the people together, then you got to break them up, and then they've got to get together and hatch this plan and try and make it work. It struggles with its concept, but I will say this. If there's anything that saves it, and if you have anything save a romantic comedy, it should be this. The chemistry between Charlie Day and Jenny Slate is phenomenal. They are absolutely adorable together, actually. They really are sweet. They work. And I was really taken in by this movie. And even though there's parts of it that it just, there's a whole bit where Jenny Slate somehow gets involved with, he's a theater teacher at a high school, and they're putting on a production of Little Shop of Horrors, and somehow she's brought in to play as an understudy for Audrey, the girl in there. And there's a lot of stuff that if you even just know the rudimentary elements of drama in general, that just doesn't work. I mean, I don't know. Why would you have a grown woman be an understudy in a middle school play? There's a whole bunch of stuff. But I can forgive that. And I can forgive the real clunkiness in there because, you know, there's like Gina Rodriguez is okay, although she's not given much to work with. But Scott Eastwood plays Jenny Slate's ex. And look, Scott Eastwood, really good looking guy, and he looks like a young version of Clint Eastwood, but he is not the same actor that Clint Eastwood is. He just does not have the acting chops that Clint, his father, does. And he just kind of comes off cold in everything he does. So there's elements that don't work, but honestly, the chemistry between Charlie Day and Jenny Slate absolutely saves this movie and makes it kind of an adorable watch. So I'm going to have to say that I Want You Back kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Death on the Nile and Blacklight. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's now talk about another movie, one of the big ones that's out this week, and that is Death on the Nile. Kenneth Branagh, hot off an Oscar nomination, by the way. Kenneth Branagh directs this Agatha Christie mystery about the legendary detective Hercule Poirot, who must solve a murder on a riverboat in the Nile.
Please welcome the newlyweds, Mr. and Mrs. Simon Doyle.
You must meet Hercule Poirot.
My congratulations, madame.
He's only the greatest detective alive.
I suspect you invited me for reasons other than the fun.
When you have money, no one is ever really your friend.
Someone is dead. The crime is murder.
You accused me of murder.
He accuses everyone of murder.
It is a problem, I admit.
There was a Death on the Nile theatrical feature that came out in the 80s. It starred Peter Ustinov. And what's interesting, my mother is a huge Agatha Christie fan. She's read all the books, and she's a huge Hercule Poirot fan and a Miss Marple fan. She has some very, very strong opinions on the actors and actresses that have played those characters over the years. And as fun as Peter Ustinov was as Poirot, he was not the Poirot from the book. And that was always was the thorn in my mother's side. I took her to go see this, and she had seen Murder on the Orient Express. And basically, Branagh's doing with this what he did with Murder on the Orient Express, where it's this big ensemble piece where he's got this great cast of actors put together, and everybody is a suspect, and you're in this very tightly written mystery. And I use the term mystery a little looser here, because this is not like an episode where they lay things out and the viewer can really figure it out. There's two different ways to do a mystery. One is to put all the clues out there for somebody to see. And there's another one where you go through the process of discovery. I don't think that's how Christie necessarily wrote this book or Murder on the Orient Express, but how Kenneth Branagh has delivered the movies is more of you watching somebody solve the mystery rather than you guessing like a weekly formulaic TV series. And one of the things Branagh does is he dials back the character a bit. He probably got some feedback that he was a little bit over the top with the Poirot character in Murder on the Orient Express. So he tones it down a little bit, doesn't make him as, I guess, flamboyant or as grandstanding as he was in the previous film. And he lets everything else sort of take control. He lets the other characters do the performance. And it's got a great cast. You got Gal Gadot as the woman who's taking everybody on the cruise. You got Armie Hammer as her husband. You've got Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders, who used to do a comedy show in Britain, Saunders and French. They're back as these two characters. You've got Annette Bening. You've got Russell Brand, who I actually didn't recognize initially. And I thought it was a bit of a diversion of stuff that Russell Brand has done. It's nice to see him doing something more than his British version of Pauly Shore. I think I'm going to get a lot of hate mails from Russell Brand's fans for just describing him as the British Pauly Shore. But anyways, the movie itself, it's lavish, it's gorgeous, it's got a beautiful set design, beautiful production design. Some of the special effects are a little bit goofy, and you get that with high-def cameras. You're not using film, and you can get some really inauthentic green screen or blue screen. And there's a couple shots in here where you're just like, it looks like they're keying somebody into a weather map at the Weather Channel or something like that. I can forgive that. The rest of it, it's a gorgeous looking movie. It's very well acted. And yes, it does play out a very legitimate mystery. I remember the original Peter Ustinov version. I thought they laid out the summation, the here's what happens and explanation of who's who and how this happened and who was the killer, et cetera, et cetera. I thought that fit better. Branagh obscures it a little bit more. And that's why I'm saying he's not making it something that the audience is necessarily going to follow through and guess. Now, obviously, if you've read the book, you've seen the original movie or one of the versions they've done on TV in the, 9 million Agatha Christie British series that you can find on BritBox and Acorn. But it's a very authentic version of Agatha Christie. I really did enjoy this one. I'm curious to see if they're going to do another one. I love this ensemble cast doing a big murder mystery from the history of British literature. So I think that was really cool. So I would say this, if you liked Murder on the Orient Express and you enjoyed how Branagh put together an Agatha Christie murder for the modern big screen, you should enjoy this one. It's quite interesting and kind of beautiful to watch. So I'm going to have to say it rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Blacklight. Liam Neeson stars as an FBI fixer who uncovers a conspiracy in which the government is targeting innocent civilians.
I've been writing about the story for over a year. The United States government is killing innocent civilians under the guise of protecting democracy. How many more would have to die for you to stop looking the other way?
Count me out. You show me a little gratitude. My end is now. If I find out you had anything to do with my granddaughter disappearing, you're gonna need more men.
Back in 2008, Liam Neeson starred in the movie Taken, and it was a huge hit, and it started him down the path of making his own little cottage industry that has lasted almost 15 years, where he's somebody in authority, he's a tough guy, and he goes out on a rampage and beats a lot of people up and kills a bunch of people because of his special skills. And they've done a dozen or so of these movies over the years. They've done like three or four Taken movies. And then every year, there's been one or two of these Liam Neeson action movies. And I'm a sucker for these. I enjoy them. When he did his last one, which I think was The Marksman, which was a year or so ago, that one I realized he's starting to get kind of old because Liam Neeson's pushing 70. And, I mean, he still looks great. I mean, he still looks very formidable. I don't want to get him beating me up in a dark alley. But I think the actor's going to, you know, he doesn't want to hurt himself. And so he does a little more driving. And that's one of the things in the last movie he did, The Marksman, and whatever the one that was before it, he basically chases people in a car more than he chases them on foot. But this one, he mixes it up a bit. He scuffles it up. He beats some people up. There's actually some hand-to-hand combat stuff that's believable. It doesn't quite feel like it's a full-blown big feature film. They're hedging around some of the action, hedging around some of the locations where it does feel like it might be, you know, maybe a direct-to-video thing or a much smaller movie than what they're trying to make it. It takes place in Washington, D.C., but I think it was filmed somewhere in Australia. And it's like when I watched that movie Brazen a couple weeks ago, the Nora Roberts movie about the woman who worked as a cam girl. That one takes place in Washington, D.C. It didn't look like it shot anywhere near Washington, D.C., and it feels like the same thing here. This is a decent little action movie. I think it steps up the game for Liam Neeson a little bit better than the more recent films, but it still has some holes in the plot. It's also, I gotta say this, it's a little bit disturbing to watch this movie. I mean, we're still suffering the effects of some pretty gnarly things that have happened in our collective national history. I mean, we have an active congressional investigation into an insurrection that happened in Washington, D.C. It makes it feel a little bit cold to make a movie dealing with similar topics where you're just like, oh, this might be cutting a little too close to the bone, where there are, either on both ends, on one hand saying, do we really want to build these conspiracy theories so whack jobs can make their own views of the way the world is? But at the same time, there are some things going on in our government that harken back to some of the nefarious stuff that happened in the 70s that got Nixon kicked out of office. So, I mean, these are the things that do kind of pour some salt into the wounds as you watch this movie. But if you can get past that, the writing's a little bit clunky. It doesn't always make sense. But I've come to a realization, when you watch a movie like this, you're there to see Liam Neeson kick butt. So that's the number one question. Does he go in there and kick butt? Yes, he does. You don't always understand why, and it doesn't always have a great explanation behind it. But if you're looking to watch Liam Neeson scuffle it up, he does a pretty good job in it, and I think he does a pretty decent job acting. I think he's given a little more meat with this one than he has the last couple movies, but it's still nowhere near the quality of the Taken films. But I'm still going to be kind to this one and say I'm going to give it a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Minamata and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Paranoiac and Gintama, the very final. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews and talk about another new movie that you can find out there in limited release. And that is Minamata. Troubled photographer W. Eugene Smith travels to Japan to uncover the devastating health and environmental impacts of toxic waste in 1971.
There's a company in Japan that's been dumping their toxic waste into the sea. The people need help. We need global attention.
I'm the greatest photographer that Life magazine has ever had.
But you are. You're the single most impossible photographer that Life has ever had.
Listen to me, I need the pictures, Gene.
Bring the story home.
The cover-up is gonna be as much of a story as the story itself.
I was surprised that this movie didn't get a bigger release. It seems to have, well, it has a decent cast to begin with. It's got Johnny Depp, and I know he's in the middle of, you know, fighting his own cancellation. And it's got Bill Nighy in there. And apparently a lot of the Japanese actors are well-known actors in Japan. They're like a film, whatever the Japanese version of the Oscar is. You've got people who have been nominated and won stuff. So they do have a strong, formidable Japanese cast in this. But at its heart, it's a story of discovery about this photographer. And he's kind of at the end of his career. He's troubled as a journalist. He's not always easy to deal with. And his editor at Life magazine is reluctant to send him on this assignment, but he does. And what's interesting about this is this thing takes place over 50 years ago. And we are at a point now where we can actually see the long-term effects of environmental things that were first brought to alert back in the 50s and 60s and 70s. I mean, I remember going through high school in the 80s and even into college in the early 90s. There were things people were questioning, saying, oh, these are environmental issues that came up in the 1970s. And it hadn't even been on the public's radar for 15 years. And so there's a lot of people who say, well, let's see what happens. We don't know if this, well, some of the stuff has played out poorly. And here's something that took place in 1971. And it's about this Japanese company that just dumps toxic waste, and in particular, mercury. And the thing with Japan is Japan's an island, and it's an awful lot of coastline. There's a lot of ocean to Japan. And so it's obviously a big chunk of their diet's going to come from fish. And if you know anything about the environment, there are certain sinks where toxic metals will end up, and fish can have high levels of mercury. And they even warn people about that if you eat a lot of fish. And that's a huge chunk of the Japanese diet. And so, of course, it's affecting this community. But then, of course, you're dealing with cultural issues, too, where you know, it was not culturally okay to be a whistleblower. You did not want to bring attention to yourself or your family, either because you're going to get retribution from the people who run the show or the government or somebody. And I mean, there's a lot of saving face going on in the Japanese culture that becomes a problem that magnifies in this sort of situation. And what's interesting, I also found about it, is it has nothing to do with American. There's a lot of people like, oh, well, you know, this environmental stuff is just anti-American and anti-the American economy. This has nothing to do with the American economy. It's all about Japan. And I think that that's a good thing to do. It's great to take a problem we're having in America and show it in a different country. And that way you're not triggered by patriotism or anything like that. You know, whereas you take a movie like Dark Waters, which came out a couple years ago about the poisoning that was going on in Kentucky from, I think it was DuPont. And you can sit there and make a lot of statements about, well, you know, it's about the economy and that's the way the people are living there. This has nothing to do with middle America. We're watching this happen somewhere else. And so if it can happen somewhere else 50 years ago, I mean, this happened the year I was born. This is something that we do need to keep an eye on. And that it brings up the point of why it's important to monitor this stuff. And if a company, whether they're American or Japanese, can get out of not paying for an expensive way to get the poisons out of their water, they may just dump it if there's no regulation against it. So, I mean, this is not a hugely pro-regulation movie, but it's showing the reason why you need a certain degree of regulation. So I find that to be important. And that, to me, is the reason to see the movie. Yeah, there's some good acting in it, too. But I think the biggest reason is to see the impact of an environmental movie done in a different country. So I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Spotlight this week is going to be on Paranoiac, which is a new release from Shout Factory, labeled under Scream Factory, because it's I wouldn't call it a horror movie as much as a thriller. Oliver Reed stars in this thriller about a family whose son that had committed suicide years before shows up again under mysterious circumstances.
Your sister is sick.
My sister's insane.
Simon Ashby.
Whose twisted, greedy mind was obsessed by an inheritance of £500,000 for 8 years. they presumed that Anthony Ashby was dead. Now, his unexpected return engulfs the Ashby family in a wave of terror.
This is a Hammer production, and Hammer is most known for doing, especially back at this time, you know, as you come out of the 50s and lean into the 60s, they were known for doing monster movies. You know, they did The Curse of Frankenstein, The Mummy, Horror of Dracula, all these things with Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing, going all the way through The Serpent and The Lizard and all these different movies through the 60s and 70s. This is very different. This is more or less Hammer's answer to Psycho, where it takes a mental condition and magnifies it into the small family. And it's about the interaction between the people in the family and the mystery behind, is this person, is this really the long-lost brother coming back, or is there something else going on there? And what are everybody's motivation? Because it's a very tight-knit but closed-off family. Oliver Reed plays a very strong performance in this. You know, you can see the power behind Oliver Reed's acting, as opposed to something like Curse of the Werewolf, which he's good in, but he's not given the same volatility that he is in this movie. And that's one of the things I really liked about this. And when I say it's the response to Psycho, or their own version of Psycho, you got that a lot in the early 60s. I think William Castle did one called Homicidal, which was, again, it was very much a Psycho type of movie. Psycho had such an impact that other studios wanted to make their own version of it. They wanted to deliver something that was as popular and as ubiquitous and as money-making as Psycho is. And that's kind of what Paranoiac is. And you know, I mean, it still feels very early 60s. It's in black and white. It's kind of a drab story. But I gotta say, it's interesting. It has enough twists and turns in it. It has some really neat imagery. It has interesting characters and where they go and how they do stuff. So yeah, it's absolutely worth checking out. And the other thing is the Blu-ray. It's a collector's edition Blu-ray. Has a whole bunch of interviews and behind the scenes features. Shout Factory does a really good job, especially with these movies that, you know, are so old that there may only be a couple people left living from the original cast. But this one, they have retrospectives and looking back. So you get some special features. They don't leave you high and dry with almost nothing, especially with these collector edition of these older horror movies and thrillers. So I gotta say, Paranoiac totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Really quickly, I want to talk a little bit more about another Blu-ray release, and that's also from Shout Factory. It's Gintama, the very final. I don't have a trailer for it, and the reason is because all the trailers I found were in Japanese. They're not going to make any sense to people on American radio. Anyways, the finale of this anime and manga series sees the team fighting to bring back their teammates, defeat their enemy, and provide a worthy narration to the series' conclusion. I've never watched the original Gintama series. I've never watched any of the anime versions. I've not read the manga. So this thing made no sense to me. I'm just going to come out. I tried to follow it. What's interesting about this is it's very self-aware and it's self-referential and it puts in humor. It gets absurd. It has a lot of fun with its own structure. Sometimes a little bit too much, especially the beginning and the end get very self-referential and it's clever. And then they kind of overstay their welcome with the joke, but that's okay. I guess that's sort of the beat of the series. Has some really good action and some great visuals. If I knew anything about the characters, I'm sure I would have really enjoyed it. But it's neat to watch. And I don't know if it's a satisfying ending because I haven't watched anything else from it, but I got to say that it kind of rocks just because it was at least interesting to watch, even if it made no sense.
It kind of rocks.
Also available for new discs, we've got King Richard, Encanto, and Resident Evil, Welcome to Raccoon City, are new this week. In terms of the vintage releases, we've got the original Spider-Man Sam Raimi trilogy in 4K. We've got Some Like It Hot in 4K. And we have the Criterion release of Miller's Crossing, the early Coen Brothers film. Plus new releases of Summer School, 12 Angry Men, Foul Play, and Surf Nazis Must Die. And that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Dog and Uncharted. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.